CEU Medieval Radio, Past Perfect, the talk show about medieval and early modern culture.
Welcome to Past Perfect, CEU's Medieval Radio podcast on all things late antique, medieval and early modern. My name is Ivan Milajković and today I'm joined by Professor Richard Price. Now, it is very hard to introduce a man who, in field of late antique studies, needs completely no introduction. However, for the wider public, Richard Price is Emeritus Professor at University of London, and by all means, one of the greatest, if not the greatest, authority on church councils, and also a very active translator who translated almost all of the acts of the councils. Professor Price, it's an honor to speak with you. Now, speaking of church council, it doesn't seem that it is a widely popular topic amongst younger scholars. In your opinion, why would it be important to study church councils, and what kind of knowledge about the past can we gain from studying church councils?
One reason why people have studied and analyzed the acts of the ecumenical, the general councils, is that these are very substantial documents. And so they seem, at first glance, to offer us immediate, purely factual information about these important meetings, not transmitted through some historian who is selective and has his own biases, but a straight, clean, objective presentation of what discussion took place. And some people thought that this is a fascinating material to show how people actually spoke within the spoken language. Now, it'd be nice if I could go along with that, and that would lead people to look at the acts. But in fact, that's a misconception of the way they were produced. Because, yes, there were minute takers who attended the sessions and wrote a full verbatim report. Those were then put together, edited, a complicated process that Thomas Graumann has written a book on. But the fact is that what was then issued as the acts of this particular council is a far more selective record. They didn't attempt to record everything that was said. They incorporated a lot of documents that presumably have not been really tampered with. But the actual discussion, they tend to give you a selective choice of speeches, interventions by bishops. And they vary greatly in the skill with which they do this. The Acts of Chalcedon, one of the best known of these councils in 451, they issued acts which read extremely well, a coherent succession of discussion. Other acts were less skillfully edited, for instance, those of the Second Council of Nicaea, 787, which formally gave approval to the setting up and veneration of images. They've been so clumsily edited that you have a series of episcopal comments that are just not related to one another, as if the bishops weren't listening to each other. So no one has to recognize that there is they are not the straight, the complete record as we get in England in Hansard, and other countries have their own form of that. But nevertheless, It is fascinating to find what are substantial, long documents giving far more information about these important councils than of any other councils in the late antique and early medieval world.
Right. Thank you. Now, it seems very interesting that, as you mentioned at the beginning, there have been a lot of misconceptions about what the councils are and what can studying church councils offer us. But this also opens, I think, the question of how has this study changed in the last 30 years? When you read, for example, Dame Averil Cameron, then we can come to a conclusion that studies of patristics have been, until a few decades ago, simply a clerical thing. Nowadays, it's a big and widespread academic interest. So from your very long and very good experience, how would you say that the studies of church councils have changed? And how has this shift to, let's say, a secular study changed the discipline, if it has changed the discipline at all?
The earlier interest was in these ecumenical councils for the doctrine they defined. And so studies of development of Christian theology would take the councils as high points when the church adopted a particular position. And they were read in the light of the theologians who expounded the doctrine contained in these councils. One thing which I've come to realize is that the doctrine as expressed in the church councils is far from precise in that, yes, brief, clear-cut statements, but they do not explain their terminology. When they say that Christ, for example, has two natures, they do not tell you how they are understanding the word nature. Or when they say that Christ has two wills, again, they have not actually asked themselves what exactly were the concepts of will that the bishops used and understood. So another thing that's become clear to me is that so far from you having, as used to be imagined, theologians thinking and arguing their disagreements, they come together and agreement is made on a particular statement of the doctrine and then that's tied up. It is almost always the other way around. First of all, there'd been a dispute. They hear, summon a council in the hope of restoring unity. They adopt a formula. But very often, the theology on which is needed to explain that formula had not, in fact, yet been developed. So you have the development of interpretation of these definitions subsequently. It is only at the end of that process that the definitions are understood to have a particular meaning.
I think this is also a very interesting point, given the fact that we, when speak about church councils, can't not speak about the acts of the councils, as is clear from your answers. Now, dealing with these acts seems, as it is, a very specific historical source, because unlike many other late antique sources, it is still used by an active and a very large community of Christians. Now, I wanted to ask you something about the process of translations, as you have translated almost all of the acts of the councils to English. Can you tell us what is the process and what are the difficulties? You mentioned that they are dealing with formulaic language. How does one translate this and how does one adapt this to a specific public, be it Anglican, Catholic, Orthodox, or academic?
There are, on the whole, standard translations of the key theological terms, and if some of them are not generally familiar, that's no problem in an edition which has introductions and footnotes. For example, we talk about miaphysitism. Now, probably the majority of theological students, let alone the wider historical community, do not immediately understand that word. So, of course, you explain what that means, simply as means with one nature. And then they say, yes, but what does nature mean? To which the answer is that the word was used very loosely. There's not an exact definition. People need to appreciate that these terms, like nature and will, were used in a wide variety of ways, for which the modern translations, of course, have their own ambiguities, but it's not always the same ambiguity that is there in the original Greek. Again, a translation has to be accompanied by a commentary that gives guidance on this. One thing I've learned too is that I'm keen on having translating into a style that reflects the complexities, the richness of the original Greek. And I have some favorite words that I've used rather often, like refractory. But reviewers have pointed out, one reviewer said that the trouble with my translations was that my vocabulary was larger than that of today's students. Well, I have learned from experience to avoid really unusual words. Some technical theological terms one has to make use of, as I say, one can explain them in a note. But part of one's task is to produce a translation that reflects the style of the original. So it will sound, somebody is bound to sound mannered to a modern reader, but one needs to get across to the readers what was the particular manner, colour of discourse used in conciliar acts, whether it's of the documents or whether it's by episcopal statements.
Right, but in that context, regarding the reviewer comment about your vocabulary, possibly every translator would say that each generation needs a new translation. Do you think that one day there will also need to be a new and modernized translation of Church Council Acts as well?
That is certainly possible. But I think, well, with experience, I think I've developed a style, a vocabulary and a style that should remain comprehensible and not sound too odd to modern literate readers. Obviously, my editions are not intended for the general public. They are intended for students and fellow scholars who they would need to develop, of course, their own kind of proper vocabulary for talking about ancient politics and ancient theology. And if the syntax in these texts can be quite elaborate, well, yes, I do sometimes break up long sentences into a series of shorter ones, but one thing that I think a translation has got to communicate is in fact the style of the original. It shouldn't simply be a paraphrase in the standard, comparatively simple modern English language.
Regarding the thing that your translations are aimed at academic audience and their academic translations proper with very good commentary and introduction. But as I said, these texts are still used by a living community. Did you ever have experience where you know that Christians who are non-academics read your translations and had some contact with it or some sort of a dialogue with the text?
To what extent have these documents actually been read? The actual decrees of councils have standardly been read by, particularly if it's a doctrinal decree. These have been regularly, of course, familiar to historians of Christian, development of Christian theology. And students studying, for example, the theology of the first millennium of Christianity, they, of course, take an interest in the development of Christian thought. So, the more wider, as it were, the layman in the pew, or the person with an interest generally in early medieval history, these are people who will not, of course, hitherto looked at the Acts. But the same is true of a large number of professional historians. All right, if you're writing a specific study of a particular council or particularly a theological debate, you may well look at, hunt out the volumes of the original Greek and make your way through them. The Greek is not really that complicated on the whole. A thing I cannot help noticing is when you find sometimes quite reputable scholars writing articles that refer to a number of councils, is that it was quite manifest to me that they had not read the original Acts, because these are long documents and they don't really have the time to do so. And one thing which my volumes are very much intended to enable is for somebody to be able to read through the text really rapidly and see what there is in it that is really of interest and importance for himself. So apart from providing, yes, careful translation, notes, introductions, as somebody really wants to work at this material in depth, I've been very conscious of the need to provide an easy read for people who want to pick up a good impression of the Council of Chalcedon, as I say, do not have the time to make their way through the Greek, original Greek and Latin texts.
Right, and we've been speaking about the audiences, but has your relationship to the text changed over the years, your viewpoints, your stances? Have they developed?
They have. I'm glad to say that each council in turn that I worked at, I was highly sympathetic to the fruits of that council. And so I read them with sympathy. and with a desire to communicate to a modern audience a positive view of how the council performed its task and the conclusions it came to. I think it's important for general historical students to approach such material with sympathy and desire to enter into the mentality of people who were at the councils or were related to those councils. And of course, as you were saying, when you have readers who are committed churchmen, particularly if they are in one of the Orthodox churches, they want to, who regard these councils with greater reverence, they want to see a positive presentation of the work of these councils. And I'm glad to say, working at each council in turn, reading these texts with sympathy, I did enter into the mentality of the bishops who were there, and I think I gave a fair presentation of their attitudes and why they came to the decisions they did. However, I must confess that over the years, looking back, I find myself gradually becoming more critical of these councils, of their work and the way they were conducted. And one thing which needs to be stressed, yes, I think Christians of East and West think in terms of the church enjoying a degree of autonomy. All right, councils were summoned by emperors who could insist on episcopal attendance, they could provide accommodation, they could even provide some funding, but the presumption has been that, like the Catholic ecumenical councils of the later medieval period and of the more modern period too, the Council of Trent, Second Vatican Council, we think of councils as a question where the bishops got together and discussed and came to their own conclusions. But the term ecumenical council in the ancient context means, above all, imperial councils summoned by emperors. What made them universal councils? Not the fact that all parts of the church were represented. Essentially, these are councils of bishops from the Byzantine Empire, or after the Arab conquest of Palestine and Egypt. After all, the churches there still looked towards the Byzantine emperor as their true overlord. They would send representatives. But essentially, these councils are attended by bishops who are living within the Byzantine Empire, present or including some parts which were no longer held there, plus, of course, always representatives of the See of Rome. Now, they were included partly because of a belief that the Pope, yes, was primus inter pares, he counted as the most, as were, senior bishop. Certainly not because he was thought to be representing the Western Church. No, it was because of papal primacy that these councils almost always had papal representatives there. And it's very important for them to come to agreement with the bishops of the East. But what, in fact, how was agreement achieved? Well, they were imperial councils in a stronger sense, the fact that the emperor sponsored them. They were generally controlled by the emperor. And the emperor dictated not only the issues to be decided, but quite rather often the actual conclusions that were drawn. The Council of Chalcedon, they wanted to produce a definition of the nature, the makeup of Christ. And they came up with their famous definition that Christ is in two natures, divine and human. Now, the Eastern bishops were uncomfortable with this. They would have preferred the expression that Christ is from two natures. And we needn't discuss here the difference in meaning between from and in this context. But what led the council to adopt the in formula is because that the Roman representatives representing the thought of Pope Leo the Great, what they insisted upon. They threatened to leave the council if the Roman preference for in two natures was not accepted. And the Eastern bishops gave way. Why did they give way? Because the emperor told them to. He threatened that if they didn't give way, he would end the council and call, and there'd be another council in the West to settle the matter. So council after council, the emperor, in fact, effectively dictates to the bishops the conclusions they are to come to. Now, of course, emperors weren't fools. They weren't tyrants who thought they could just tell the church what it had to do, what it had to believe. It was well aware that its own clout was inevitably had its limitations. But council after council, the actual matters being discussed and even the conclusions come to largely come from imperial direction. Now, of course, to modern churchmen, Eastern as well as Western, this seems like a gross interference of the secular sphere into religious matters. But the emperor was not regarded as simply as the top of the secular administration. There's one phrase that comes in the Acts of the Constantinople III, where insisting on a sort of quasi-divine authority of the emperor, which it puts the way around it puts is extraordinary. It says that Almighty God is the fellow ruler with the emperor. It's not the emperor even being a co-ruler, but God, as it were, is co-ruler with the emperor. And as late as the 15th century, the Byzantine Empire was reduced to the city of Constantinople and its immediate environment. The then Russian potentate, the Grand Prince of Kiev, wrote a letter to Patriarch Antony of Constantinople, in which we said we have a church but not an empire. And Patriarch Antony wrote back to correct him, saying, we do have an emperor. Now, he no longer makes the claim that the emperor is God's chosen master of the world, but he does say he is the ruler of all Christians. Of course, politically, it's unreal. But so this is ecumenical in this context, before the Western medieval later councils, means specifically imperial. The councils are summoned by the emperors. The emperors, in fact, determine the agenda and effectively, in a broad way at least, the decisions to become to. And it's what finally certifies the decrees of the councils is that they're then issued as imperial laws. Now, this side of in the West, we find this very alien. The division of church and state is something we take for granted. One has to be very conscious that in the late Roman context of the Christian Empire of Constantine, then moving to the Byzantine period, the emperor is, well, he wouldn't call him head of the church, but he is seen as God's viceroy on earth, whose task it is, of course, to not to dictate the bishops, to help the bishops to define the true doctrine. In practice, this means that at the councils, it is the imperial will that is the decisive element exercised by emperors, who are well aware that in practice their clout is a bit limited, so they don't adopt idiotic positions. But when the church is divided, it will be the side that the emperor supports, sometimes out as a result of his own personal study of theology and devotion, like the great emperor Justinian, who clearly was a competent theologian. But more generally, of course, they're influenced by political considerations, particularly the desire to establish friendly relations with Rome and the West. We might think that the territories held by Byzantine still in Italy for many centuries were rather secondary as regards to the eastern provinces. But after the loss of Syria and Palestine and Egypt, and then after that frequent Muslim invasions and raids into Asia Minor, which really seriously almost shattered the traditional city civilization, the Byzantine Empire regarded its holdings in the south of Italy and Sicily as one of the most prosperous parts of the empire, and they were very keen to hold on to that. And in this context, they keenly wanted to be on good terms with the papacy. So quite often, East and West came together. The papal representatives, the Byzantine bishops agreed together on some to adopt some particular theological formula. But this is under strong influence, almost direct, sometimes direction from the emperor, who insists that East and West have got to come together. So if these successful ecumenical endeavors, it's because of the role of the emperor seeing himself as God's viceroy and certainly having political interests.
Then in this context, how can we really draw a line between what is politics and what are domestic politics of the empire and what are theological, dogmatic and religious matters, if we can draw a steady line at all?
If the political motive is the emperor to try and hold Rome, Constantinople, and particularly before the initial 7th century Arab conquests with the ancient patriarchates of Syria, Palestine, and Egypt, yes, certainly politics enter into it, but then in these parts of the Christian world, the clergy, the great laity, had a great loyalty to what they saw as the tradition, Christian tradition, of teaching in their own countries. So, of course, emperors had to take this into account. And I would say that they were sort of very conscious. Generally speaking, yes, they show a concern. They themselves are committed Christian to achieve common doctrine. But here, the theological interest of establishing some shared belief and shared expression of belief throughout the church is there. But of course, the political angle of holding the empire together plays a role. One really can't separate those two. It'd be unreal to sort of press what was really motivating the emperor. He himself is a human being with a whole variety of interests and concerns here.
Regarding another interesting point you mentioned, the difference between East and West, it's you're at CEU as a keynote speaker to the upcoming conference entitled From Ctesiphon to Toledo, which deals with comparative view of Eastern and Western councils. Now, of course, ecumenical councils are in the East, the Empire and the Emperor are on the East, but there are still some councils on the West. What would be the biggest difference between those important Eastern councils and smaller and to an extent less important Western ones?
Well, the particular two councils I've selected are both rather unusual in certain respects. The Roman council I'm talking about was very serious, theological council, which doctrine was discussed at a high level of competence. Under the guidance of Maximus the Confessor and other monks from the East who, fleeing from the Arab invasions, made their way to Rome and were very much keen collaborators with the popes, that council, it's really taking part in what's essentially an Eastern debate over the certain details of Christology. And what I'm going to talk about this evening is the contrast between this council and the ecumenical council held in Constantinople some over 20 years later, 30 years later, which discussed the same issues. And the contrast there is between a Western council in Rome, which is theologically very well informed, and an Eastern council, which produces a definition which the terms are not defined, and in which appeal is made to earlier patristic texts that use similar formulations. But there is no evidence of a serious theological discussion going on at these councils between those bishops who are theologically competent and the actual meaning of these definitions. So the actual level of theological debate, quite often in these councils, as it's presented in the council acts, is not in fact a very high one. And what is produced at the end is a definition, a really rather short definition, in which the terms are not defined. So what is produced has undoubtedly an ambiguity. Now, we might expect bishops coming together are going to hold a serious theological debate. Well, to what extent did this happen? You have long citations from church fathers that use the formulas and terms which they now wish to put in a definition. There's a lot of citation, and sometimes some very digging up great variety of texts from earlier Christian writing. There's a lot of good scholarship goes into it. But the level of theological debate, well, in fact, there's really not very much that could be called straight theological debate. The bishops adopt formulas, but they don't have serious discussion about what exactly these formulas mean. And this means that, although clearly the concern is with the truth of the Christian faith, but it means the political element of achieving harmony in the church through agreed formulas is actually the prime element. I mean, either where there is quite easy to achieve agreement can be achieved, or where there isn't, of course, where there are serious differences in formulas, they have to adopt one formula rather than another. But still, the desire is adopt a under imperial direction to adopt definitions that will be accepted both in the West and in at least large parts of the East. So this angle, to call it political, perhaps be a bit pejorative, but the aim is essentially to restore harmony in the church through agreed formulas. That is the aim, not to discuss what exactly these formulas mean. And that's why I said that so often the development is, it's not the theological debate that leads to the council being able to define something that is generally understood. So to find formulas adopted to establish continuing communion harmony between East and West, and it's the task of later theologians to actually develop the theological understanding that makes sense of these definitions, that gives them a definite meaning, and which fits them into a developed and harmonious doctrine about God and Jesus Christ.
What seems as a possibility is that you now have bishops from the Greek-speaking East and the Latin-speaking West together. Do we know, or do you have a guess, whether there was any linguistic barrier or a linguistic divide between
Now, this
them.
Is something which I missed when I did my first translation of the Council of Chalcedon, because there was the leading papal representative, Paschasinus, and the sub-sessions he virtually chairs, and I asked myself, did he really understand what all the Greek bishops were saying? He himself always spoke in Latin. This is made quite clear. He was not going to speak in Greek. It reminds me of Russian representatives attending the patristic conference in Oxford who used to insist on speaking in Russian. Of course they knew English. They wouldn't otherwise have come. They wanted to make a point that Russian was a serious theological language. So at these councils, the Western representatives would speak in Latin, which had to be translated into Greek, of course, if the Greek bishops were to understand it. But a fact that I should have known is that Paschasinus came from Sicily, which was Greek-speaking. He would have been bilingual, quite certainly.
Regarding an earlier note that you mentioned, it seems like dogma or heresies are like a Schrödinger's cat. One dogma is both a heresy and not a heresy until it wins. So what are the mechanisms and process of how one doctrinal position wins and the other one becomes a heresy?
Now, to what extent was there what we would call serious theological debate? There's something of that, but much less than we might have expected. But the trouble here partly is that it's a mistake to think that the Acts are a complete record. Now, at the Council of Chalcedon, the incisive session was the fifth session in which the draft definition produced by a committee was presented and discussed by the bishops, and a large number of Eastern bishops objected to the use of a formula deriving from Pope Leo the Great's tome, talking of Christ being in two natures, and said that they much preferred the from two natures formula that the great Cyril of Alexandria had developed. And Cyril of Alexandria was regarded in the Greek East as being the greatest writer on Christology. Now, at this session, there were clearly, the Acts do tell us that the Greek bishops expressed unhappiness in formula in two natures. But the fact is that the session went on for hours until they finally adjourned it while consulting the emperor across the Bosphorus. And the emperor wrote back, firmly dictated how they had to come together. A small committee of bishops had to come together. They had to accept the Roman formula and then present that. The rest of the bishops rubber stamped it. But this initial discussion among the bishops, it must have gone on for some time, would well have been really not just slogans being chanted against each other, but there must have been elements of a real theological discussion. But none of that comes in the Acts. The Acts gives a very, it only gives a few pages. And one wonders with other, take the next great council, Constantinople II in 553 under Justinian. The documentation consists very largely of texts that have been read out. Yes, this is important in all councils, reading out florilegia, collections of relevant statements in early church fathers. They're always very keen to, we must follow the tradition of the church. But to what extent were these texts read? To what extent were they then discussed by the bishops? In the Council of 553, there's very little in the way of interventions by the bishops rather than a few leading bishops and imperial representatives. Now, does that mean that the great majority of bishops sat there in silence? Or is it rather there was discussion that was not included in what were finally the published acts? Now, this is the trouble is one's not entering an area of guesswork. But one thing I think one can say is that the amount of serious, which we've called proper theological debate and discussion was limited. These are not academic seminars, academic classes for people to discuss. And great trouble is taken in producing citations from earlier church fathers. They're always keen to say this is the traditional teaching, and you could have some quite sophisticated discussion about particular texts, their authenticity, or is this text really representative of this church father? So that level of learning and discussion about the sources is very much present. The amount of what we would call genuine theological debate, it seems very limited. I think one can reasonably conclude that there wasn't actually very much. But as I say, that's a bit of a caveat, because that session at Chalcedon, there might well have been quite a lot of theological discussion, which then was omitted from the published, you could say, record, because which wanted to present as much as it could bishops in agreement.
It seems very obvious that there is a strong authority of church fathers and of patristic literature. But for council participants, when does the era of church fathers end? And did they look at earlier councils and especially participants of earlier councils as church fathers as well?
You have reading out of substantial extracts from earlier, the proceedings of earlier church councils, very much so. You have these florilegia collections of brief extracts from fathers who were pre-prepared, but also, for example, at Nicaea II, over the veneration of images, the bishops were invited to come up, not with theological arguments, but to come up from citations of earlier Christian writers, and also in this context, the of more popular hagiography that provided support for the veneration of images. In my commentary, I raised the question as to whether the bishops themselves did their homework and presented these passages that they then stand up and say there's also a passage in St. Basil, or whether in fact these collections of relevant extracts have been pre-prepared and just assigned to bishops to read out, to give them, suggest that these represent the common view of the bishops rather than simply one writer's personal compilation.
To go back to the question of study of church councils. Study of church councils is basically study of late antique councils, but would you find any parallels or a continuation of all of these, not only debates, but ideas and processes in later councils, in, for example, Council of Constance or medieval councils like or early modern councils like Trent and so on? We could even go to the Second Vatican Council.
Yes, to what extent were these, the decrees of the councils were, of course, circulated, included in canonical collections. They would have been widely read. But a problem that I don't know the answer to, and I'm hoping I'm going to, when I speak this evening, urging younger scholars who still have, you know, this is a very good field to explore, is the extent to which the conciliar acts did actually circulate and were read. They're not, as I said, they're not simply the stenographic record of everything that was read out and said that had to be, you know, like modern records of parliamentary debates, then stored away in the archives somewhere. These are carefully edited texts in which there is a lot is omitted, and sometimes there are elements in them that that we can tell are simply fictitious. I'm going to talk this evening about the first seven sessions of the Third Council of Constantinople that define the crisis two wills and two operations. Now, uniquely for this council, we have a narrative account of its first seven sessions in the Liber Pontificalis, which is a Roman collection of short biographies of each of the popes in turn. And this gives a summary account of these first seven sessions. Well, the number of sessions, their dates, the order of sessions is different from that in the Greek Acts, which will then translate into Latin, of course, the official acts. And in fact, it's the record in the Liber Pontificalis that makes sense, while the order in the Greek acts does not make good sense. And if you say, well, why do they rearrange it? In order to establish a sort of sequence, a hierarchy of authority, you start with citing preceding councils, then you get on to papal statements, because the Pope is the chief of all bishops, and then you make your way down to at a lower level, so that the sequence follows that. It's clear even from the statements contained in the Greek Acts that the actual historical order of discussion was really very different. Now, this, of course, is an unusual case. But yes, the Acts are carefully a compiled record, which must be serving a propagandist purpose. But then you ask, how widely did they circulate? And this has got to be studied. It's manifest that official copies, one had to be sent to Rome, one in Constantinople, well, one copy sent to each of the Eastern patriarchs, Antioch, Jerusalem, and Alexandria. But more did they circulate. When you get to the conciliar synopses, which give you an account of all the councils and state what they define, their central work, these very rarely show any knowledge of the Acts at all. The Acts certainly circulated more widely than simply to the patriarchs, because we do hear sometimes of copies of conciliar Acts, even in private hands. But it's a matter that needs discussion, needs research as to how widely they did circulate and how widely they were used, and therefore what importance they have in the knowledge of development, the understanding of Christian doctrine and church history. So this is very much a task that needs to be undertaken by somebody younger than myself. It was the time and the interest to go through controversial literature and writings of church historians to see what they find there. I think they'll find that the large parts of the Acts of Chalcedon circulated widely, but the decrees of later councils circulated probably a good deal less. But this is a matter that requires research, which I hope some younger scholars than myself, perhaps with wider knowledge than Byzantine literature that I have, that this would be a very important matter to analyse and explore.
To sum up the interview, it's perfectly clear that there are still many subjects to be explored in study of church councils, but with regard to our introduction, we note that church councils are not as popular among younger scholars as they are among some senior scholars. What would be your advice, as I can say the greatest authority on this subject, for emerging scholars and for younger scholars in this topic?
I think a chief reason why younger scholars the whole not read these acts is really a matter of their length, and I'd hope that my translations will lead to them being much more widely read, and people appreciate that these texts are important. I'd almost say not so much of the theology as for what they reveal about the politics of the church and the motives of the various parties involved in these councils. So those who are interested in, you might say, politics are conducted, those interested in the question of the particular role and status of the emperor and of the pope, these are matters of general interest. And so I would hope that my translations will stimulate a great deal of fresh work. Of course, plenty of good scholars around, young or older, whose Greek and Latin is perfectly good, but these are long texts, and people I hope my notes introductions are useful, but the purpose of my translation is to enable people, without spending an inordinate amount of time, to read through Acts and see what there is there that they can really is worth exploring. And I think there's a general interest in church councils extending well beyond ecumenical ones, but generally all you have are some decrees and limited information about how the council's conducted. These ecumenical councils do give scope for a much closer examination. At the same time, as I said, one has to be aware that they are not complete or impartial records. One has to be aware that they're likely to be selective, and the occasions where there is straight falsification, I think very rare, but I thought I could be talking about one this evening. But again, the student has to be on his guard, as he is, of course, when he reads ancient historians, contemporary historians, or slightly later ones. The Council Acts gives a lot of material for discussing politics in a broad sense within the church, between church and state, between East and West. So they're a very rich source that I think will be more fully used now that my translations make reading through these long texts quite an arduous task. And so, yes, I think they deserve study, particularly from historians, rather more than for theologians, because as I've already said to you, there's not very much a proper theological debate at these councils, partly because it is omitted by acts that want to represent the bishops of more of one mind than they were, and partly because this important consideration that the prime criterion of Christian orthodoxy is fidelity to the tradition. Theology is not seen in these centuries as being a question of developing Christian thought. That phrase, the development of Christian doctrine, is a modern one. Their concern is to proclaim and define doctrines that have been inherited, and the chief test of truth is whether you find these doctrines taught by earlier fathers. Carefully produced florilegia argue that the fathers had teaching on these matters, where a modern historian will perhaps likely to point out that when the fathers were writing at a slightly earlier date, the theology had not yet been fully developed and a general understanding had yet to be reached.
I do hope that your translations will be widely read among younger scholars, as well that there will be plenty of cutting-edge research made using your translations. Professor Price, it was truly an honor to have you at CEU Medievals Radio, and thank you for participating.
Thank you for doing me the honor of inviting me to be interviewed by you and to say something and communicate it to your students here. I feel there are many better scholars than I nowadays who produce very impressive monographs, but so many that one's conscious that, particularly with the stress on looking at recent literature, that many of these monographs in one, two, three generations will not still be read. It's a thought that it's unlikely that my translations will be replaced by new ones, though sometimes my vocabulary is a bit too complicated. But I'd like to think that what I've done, which is a basically fairly humble task of translating, writing notes, introductions, my work will live on after my death and will help new generations of scholars to explore this material and to enter immediately into its riches and the huge scope there is for studying from it how politics, secular as well as ecclesiastical, developed and how bishops, how they thought about these matters.
Thank you, and thank you for listening to CEU's Medieval Radio.
Thank you.